Well, thank you very much, Dean Jeffries, for that very generous introduction, and I'm not going to try to replicate either the singing or the sliding today, but I do want to talk about side agreements in business transactions, and what I want to say is that side agreements, first of all, are not sideshows. They are often the main event in business transactions, but too long courts and commentators have not paid enough attention to these side agreements. So what I want to try to do today is to move side agreements more to the center stage and examine them and their role in various business transactions. Now, my interest in the topic grows not only out of my interest in contracts generally, but also my involvement in the Enron case as an expert witness, an engagement that continues as far as I know. The case hasn't settled yet, but at least I can talk about the things that I'm going to talk about here. So Enron, of course, has many stories about it, and one of the things that I think is underappreciated is the role of contracts. The corporate law scholars are accustomed to talking about corporations as a nexus of contracts. Well, under that metaphor, Enron was a nexus of fraudulent contracts, and side agreements played an important part in that nexus. So the implications of Enron for corporate law and corporate governance have been talked about at great length, but not so much the implications for contract law and contract theory, and that's in part what I want to do today. So there are several questions that I want to consider, including why parties make side agreements in the first place, when are they good, when are they harmful, how should the law treat them, and how do they impact the way we think about contract law and contract theory. So let me sort of state where I'm going first, and then try to back up and get there in a more logical way. So basically what I want to try to argue is that side agreements are an example of the importance of third-party interests in contracts, and in particular, the outgrowth of what I'm going to call the use of contracts as property and contracts demarcating property, both of which are increasingly important aspects of our economy. So side agreements tend to appear when what I will call a main agreement is being used as a kind of property, that is, a kind of asset. And also in situations where the agreement may try to structure, the main agreement that is, may try to structure the nature of rights in property, determining things like who owns the property and the like, in which third parties have some kind of interest. So what do I mean by these things? Well, contract as property is not an entirely new idea. Art Leff, who was a professor of contract some years ago, wrote an article called Contract as Thing, where he talked about some aspects of contract as property. But basically, the idea is that there are some uses of contract that involve third-party reliance on the contract itself, what I'm calling the main agreement. And there are a variety of ways this can happen, ranging from things like transfers of contract rights through assignment or negotiation of negotiable instruments or sales of accounts receivable, which are essentially just contracts as well. In more recent times, not only have contracts been sold in this way, but they've been bundled up together with other similar kinds of contracts and divided up into small pieces and sold as pieces, what is known in the fancy jargon as securitization. Contracts can also serve as a kind of property because they can be collateral for loans or an indication of creditworthiness. Contracts also show up indirectly in financial statements, which, of course, is relevant to Enron. And also relevant to Enron is the second aspect of the contract as property idea, that is contracts, what I'm calling contracts demarcating property. And what I mean by this is that contracts can also structure ownership and other kinds of property characteristics, with the result that is well known to our tax colleagues and to other transactional lawyers, that many transactions that have similar economic structures and effects may have very different legal consequences, and third parties may be relying on a particular version of those consequences. So to give some examples, which will come back in some of the cases that I'm going to talk about a little bit later, you can have, for example, a loan, a secured loan with collateral under which someone borrows money to make some kind of investment while putting up some kind of asset as collateral for the loan. Or you can have something that is the equivalent of that loan, but legally potentially very different, which is you can sell an asset to someone else and then promise to buy it back at a fixed price with some little bit extra, which could look very much like a loan with interest, with the property that's being sold as serving the purpose as the property as collateral in the loan. Or another slight variation, you can have a sale of the property and have a lease back of that property with an option to buy the property at the end, which also looks a lot in many cases like a loan, with the lease payments being the interest and other payments that would otherwise be made on the loan. And to make a slight reference to the politics of today, which is the only reference I'll make to the election, we have on the ballot the first amendment question to the Virginia Constitution, which is controversial for many reasons, but one of which has to do with exactly this kind of problem of contract demarcating property. That is, we have a what might be called a property right known as marriage, and the question is how much are we going to allow, or how much does this amendment allow the law and people to sort of structure their arrangements to approximate that? And this amendment tries to squish that out, and we'll see what happens to it. But that's another example of the same phenomenon. So that's the main agreement as property, or contract as property, or contract demarcating property. Now, how do side agreements fit in? Well, side agreements are private deals about information, and it's information that affects the value of the contract as property, or the ownership characteristics of the contract that demarcates property. And that second contract, the contract, the side agreement, is kept hidden from the interested third parties who are otherwise trying to figure out what the value of the property is or what the property characteristics of the main agreement are. And side agreements basically are bad when there's no good justification for keeping this information secret from the third parties, which is otherwise known as fraud. They're good when there might be some legitimate reasons to keep this information from the third parties. So so that's basically what I want to get to about side agreements. The broader question that I think side agreements raise has to do with the relevance of third-party interests to contracts and contract theory more generally. Now, contract law in general tends to minimize the importance of third-party interests. That is, that by and large, contract law tends to treat all contracts the same, whether they're contracts that are used as property or contracts that demarcate property or just any other ordinary kinds of contracts. They're all treated essentially the same by contract law in many contexts. And I have, as the dean alluded to, tried to argue in other work that I've done on contracts that the reason for the breach of contracts does matter and ought to matter, despite some statements that you see to the contrary, in determining what the law of contracts is and should be. In this lecture, what I want to try to argue is that third-party interests matter as well. So that's contract law. Now, as far as contract theory goes, economic theory has done a lot of interesting work analyzing the question of why people write the contracts they do, and that work can be very helpful in informing the law's approach to regulating and enforcing contracts. But much of this theory ignores the side agreement kind of phenomenon, ignores the contract as property phenomenon, ignores third-party rights, and treats contracts as essentially solely a two-party phenomenon, which is very often useful for reasons of theoretical convenience and otherwise, but not always descriptive of what is going on in reality. So that is another point that I want to make. And then finally, as a result of that, I want to try to think about how we might rethink the paradigm of contracts as simple two-party transactions to take more account of the phenomenon of contract as property and contracts demarcating property, and to take into account the interests of third parties who are not at the bargaining table and may be disadvantaged by these contracts. And I'm going to try to make some suggestions about how we might do this, including talking about the old favorite of contract law scholars, the parole evidence rule, which is essentially just that rule that says that if there's some kind of final written agreement, then agreements made before or at the same time as the main agreement are generally not enforceable except when they are, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. I want to talk a little bit about how the parole evidence rule might be affected by these, the kind of side agreements that I'm interested in. In general, the parole evidence rule has taken the tack that what we want to try to do is encourage parties to put as much as possible in the main agreement, and that the concern is that side agreements are bogus and we ought to be wary of them. And that may very well be true, but in the kind of side agreements that I'm interested in, the fear is exactly backwards. The side agreement is the main deal. It's the real thing. It's the main agreement that is the bogus Potemkin village. And so that may lead us to rethink some aspects of the parole evidence rule. Similarly, for contract theory, the main paradigm that has developed ever since Coase and people following him involves... Hooray! All right. Involves something known as the complete contract paradigm, or what I'm calling the complete contract paradigm, which is similar to the goals of the parole evidence rule, which is that basically everything should be put in this one main agreement, and the contract should be designed with that kind of goal in mind. And again, I'm going to try to suggest that side agreements throw a little bit of a monkey wrench in that basic idea. Okay, so that's where I want to try to go in the next couple of minutes, to try to flesh out some of these ideas and talk about side agreements and some of the problems with them. And let me just add, I guess, before I get back into the body of the talk, what a great honor it really is to be standing here and to have this chaired position and to follow in the footsteps of people like Saul Levmore and Paul Mahoney, who really are stellar members of the faculty, both current and former, and it really is a great honor to be another recipient of this chair. And I appreciate all of you coming as well and spending this election day listening to this different kind of fraud. Let me start with the question of what I mean by side agreements. I've given you some inkling of it, but I want to flesh that out a little bit. And if you take a look at Black's Law Dictionary, as my research assistant, Jeff Weber, who's sitting in the audience, has done for me, the definition is singularly unilluminating. Basically, the definition just says, a side agreement is an agreement that's ancillary to another agreement. Well, as George Will would say, well... That tells us almost nothing. So I want to try to flesh out the kind of definition of side agreements that I'm interested in here. So, what do I mean by side agreements? Well, the side agreements I'm interested in are agreements that are separate from the main agreement, made at the same time as the main agreement, dealing with the same subject matter as the main agreement, with the same parties as the main agreement, but either undermining or contradicting or modifying in some significant way the main agreement. So the main agreement giveth and the side agreement taketh away, essentially. And since it's always a great opportunity at these kinds of things to make up new vocabulary words, I will try to follow in the footsteps of one of my favorite contract scholars, Grant Gilmore, who was a professor at Yale and wrote a book dealing with the relationship between contracts and torts, among other things, in which he penned the famous nomenclature contorts to describe the confluence of contracts and torts in a somewhat tongue-in-cheek way. And so I thought, well, I'm talking about the relationship between contracts and property, so how can I sort of put those two together? And I thought about it for a while, and I came up with PropCon, which is not very, doesn't sound very good, but it has a purpose. The prop part is the main agreement, both in terms of serving as property, the contract as property, and as the prop. That is, it's what's held out to the public, that the public or the third party that's relying on it sees. And then the side agreement... You can figure this out. The side agreement is the con part. The side agreement basically is the part that completes the fraud and also is the part that represents the real contract that is going on underneath the surface. All right, so it's time for a concrete example after all this abstraction. And, of course, I want to turn first to Enron to talk about my first example. And Enron, of course, always presents a challenge because so many of the deals in Enron are complicated and hard to explain, but there are some that are pretty simple. And so the one I want to tell is a simple story, and it's the story of the Nigerian barges. And the story of the Nigerian barges is essentially that Enron owned three barges, which were essentially floating power plants that were supposed to supply electricity to Nigeria. And Enron didn't want to own them anymore. It wanted to sell them. The problem is, no one wanted to buy them because they weren't worth very much. I think when Enron tried to approach people, and this is for my children, the people said, "Barges? We don't need no stinking barges." So essentially, Enron couldn't sell the barges. I apologize. Enron couldn't sell the barges, so Enron goes to Merrill Lynch. And Merrill Lynch says, "What do we need with barges? We don't buy barges." And Enron says, "Oh, I think you do." And here's why. You do a lot of business with us. $40 million worth of business with us in the last year, and there's $40 million worth of new business if you do buy these barges. But we'll make it worth your while, and here's how we'll make it worth your while. We will pretend to sell the barges to you. How does that work? Well, we'll pretend to sell them. We will sell them, ostensibly, and you will pay us money for them. But in 6 months' time, after we've reported this as a sale for purposes of accounting and reporting and the like, we will buy it back from you with a little bit extra for you. So we have the main agreement, which is the presumed sale. We have the side agreement, which is the promise to buy back the barges at some later time. Enron is what I'm going to be calling the primary party to this side agreement. It's the main mover and shaker. Merrill Lynch is the secondary party. And as I said, Merrill Lynch does this at some degree of economic persuasion or coercion, or as a favor, if you want to put it in more polite terms, to Enron. Now, the sale agreement, the main agreement, is the one that is, of course, shown to the accountants, and which shows up in the financial statements of Enron for the financial reporting period. The side agreement, of course, is not shown to the accountants, but it's the main agreement that basically allows Enron to report income and profit on which the investors and others rely. And, of course, Enron at the later point does repurchase the barges through one of the so-called special purpose vehicles, which we don't need to get into here, and so that completed the fraud. And, in fact, this resulted in the first criminal convictions of several Merrill Lynch executives in the Enron case several years ago, convictions that I have to report for honesty were thrown out last summer, but on what non-lawyers would refer to as a technicality. That is, the court said they were charged with the wrong kind of fraud among three different kinds of fraud they were charged with, and since you couldn't tell which one they were convicted of, the convictions were thrown out. But the court did not condone any of the activities of the parties in this case. And more recently, last week, the Delphi case is a very similar kind of, involves, among other things, very similar kinds of side deal kinds of agreements to the Enron barge case. All right, so that's an example, a sort of paradigm example of what I mean by side agreements. Now, let me just talk a little bit about what I don't mean to include in this discussion just briefly to compare it to the barge example. I'm not talking about situations where you have parties that use multiple documents that are intended to be read together and reference each other so that they're presented in one coherent, unified agreement. I'm not talking about the opposite situation where you have multiple documents that conflict with each other and the parties disagree about which is the relevant document, what the contracts people like to call a battle of the forms problem and the like. I'm not talking about side agreements that are preliminary agreements that are done prior to some final agreement and are trumped or superseded by the final agreement. I'm not talking about modifications that occur after some final agreement. I'm not talking about implied agreements where nothing is discussed about the side agreement, but there's some implication based on past conduct or the like about what the side agreement means. These are side agreements that are expressly entered into either orally or in writing in some cases. I'm also not talking about agreements that deal with unrelated matters. These are, as I said, matters that are the same matters as the main agreement, and they're intentionally entered into. They're not accidentally or unintentionally omitted. All right, so that's what I'm not talking about. And so we have an example of the Enron barges which is one of the things, an example of the main thing that I'm worried about. And one might fairly ask, well, so what? That's Enron, and Enron is sort of unique. How do we know that this is really a big problem? And of course, the honest answer to that is we don't, because side agreements are often hidden, and they don't always surface. In many cases, they do, but they don't always. But they do surface with some regularity, especially in situations of bankruptcy and the like. And there are a fair number of litigated cases that do address side agreements or do describe fraud and the like where side agreements were present. And I've never seen cases where courts have come across side agreements and have said, oh, I've never seen this before. The reaction is usually much more like, oh, side agreement, fine, whatever. Okay, we go on from there. So, and it turns out that side agreements have existed for a fairly long period of time. I don't know how long, but I've at least seen cases from the 19th century addressing a problem of side agreements with an insurance company, an insurance corporation that basically had agents that sold shares in the insurance company, and the side agreement was that the people who bought the shares didn't have to pay the full amount, with the result, unhappily, that when the insurance company went bankrupt, many insurance policyholders didn't get full payment and the like. So it's at least as old as that, and probably much older as well. And as I said, side agreements are prominent in the Enron case. They also show up in lots of other recent financial scandals. Some other small evidence of this is a recent meeting of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which talked about, they're talking about revising rules dealing with revenue recognition and the like, and they addressed the problem of side agreements, and in the notes for the meeting, there was a reference to the fact that side agreements that have not been properly reflected in accounting records have resulted in multiple revenue restatements over the last few years. So there's at least some anecdotal and circumstantial evidence that side agreements are a pretty important phenomenon engaged in by pretty sophisticated people with lots of money at stake. Now, one might also ask, well, what is so special about side agreements? Why are they any different than any other kinds of means of committing fraud? And that also is, I think, a fair question. And I don't have a full answer to that, but let me offer at least a couple of suggestions. One is that side agreements used for fraudulent purposes tend to involve a kind of omission, that is, hiding of the side agreement, rather than commission, that is, an affirmative misrepresentation, although there is a kind of misrepresentation of a sort. But the practical result is it may be harder in many cases to find side agreements. That is, there may be situations where people within a company, agents, employees, and the like, may see and believe in main agreements and have no idea that there is some side agreement floating around somewhere that they have not been exposed to. Similarly, side agreements have a nice way of co-opting some people who might otherwise blow the whistle on the fraud, namely the other party to the side agreement. So in the Enron case, for example, you have Merrill Lynch, who's a bank, who is made a party to the side agreement, and of course, for that reason, has less incentive to say anything about it later on. And then there's also back to the phenomenon of contract as property. If you compare that to more tangible kinds of property, of course, contract as property may be easier to hide as well than more physical kinds of property, which has to be lugged around and put in warehouses or basements or something of that sort. Okay, so that's a little bit about why side agreements might be important. Let me give two more examples that concrete examples of side agreements that are similar to, but in some important ways different from the barge example, and then talk a little bit about how the law might deal with these agreements. So one recent example comes from the recent bankruptcy of a Belgian software company known as Learnout and Housebee. And the side agreement story that I want to talk about here is related in part to the Enron barge story, but it has an extra little step that I think is interesting. So the first main agreement in the Belgian software story is that you have this software company that has this supposedly wonderful new product for something called speech recognition technology that it is going to sell to customers, and it says it has all these sales to customers in Korea and other places, sales that total some $100 million supposedly. However, there is a side agreement with these sales, and the side agreement with the customers basically says that the customers actually don't have to pay for this software unless they can find some kind of viable commercial use for the product, which, as it turns out, there wasn't in many cases, and so there wasn't payment either. That's the first kind of fraud. But there's still a little potential problem there in that if you have contracts for the sale of something and you have people who don't have any obligation to pay, there's no money. Where's the money? You might need to show money to people. So the Belgian software company had a solution to that. They said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to make property, contracts as property, and we're going to sell the revenue from these contracts to our banks. That is a sale of the accounts receivable, or in the fancy jargon, factoring of the accounts receivable to these banks. So we're going to sell these contracts or the revenue from the contracts to the banks, and then we're going to have this money that the banks pay put in these special accounts, and that we're going to show to our accountants and investors and other creditors and the like, and show how much money we are making. And the wonderful thing is that the purchase by the bank is going to be on what's called a non-recourse basis, which means that essentially if the customers don't pay, the bank does, and not the software company. That was the main agreement, or the second main agreement. And as I said, that money was relied on by investors, or at least this is the charge, relied on by investors and creditors and the like. Now, the second side agreement with the banks was that, in fact, the software company couldn't touch that money in the accounts because, in fact, the money was actually pledged as collateral for revenue on the contracts with the customers of the software company, meaning, essentially, that the sale to the bank was with recourse, that if the bank didn't get paid by the customers of the software company, they could look to these accounts held by the software company and take the money out of that, which, in fact, is what the banks did eventually, covering some $53 million out of these software accounts when the customers wound up not paying. All right, so here we have a situation where, again, accountants, investors are deceived, and perhaps even other customers and suppliers of the software company who might have been led to believe that the software company has a viable product that people actually want to buy and are buying. Okay, so that's example number two. Example number three, and this is the last one I'm going to talk about in any detail and then refer back to these. Example number three doesn't involve any sort of recent financial scandals, but it does involve chicken, so it's fun to talk about. And it involves Arkansas, too, which also makes it fun to talk about. So here's what happens with the chicken company. You have a chicken company that needs a bigger freezer for its chickens, to store its frozen chickens, but it doesn't have any money to build the freezer. So what does it do? Well, it goes to the person who's going to build the freezer, and it says, let's make this agreement. And the agreement is, I'm going to sell you the land on which the freezer is going to be built, and then I'm going to lease it back for a period of several years, 6 years, and then I'm going to get an option to buy it, the whole shebang, from you at the end. And the price that we're going to pay in this option is what's called fair market value. That is what any reasonable person would pay for this property. So that's the main agreement, the chicken company and the builder. Now, they had a side agreement. What was the side agreement? The side agreement was that the real price to buy the property back, the option at the end, was actually the difference between the lease payments and the construction cost plus the interest. Or in other words, the amount that the chicken company would actually have to pay to the builder if it was borrowing the money from the builder to build the freezer and using the land as collateral at a rate that actually turned out to be floating or fluctuating with the changing interest rates. And at the time of the agreement, the interest rates were very high. So essentially, the chicken company is pretending to have a lease with an option to buy later, but really it has a loan. from the builder because of the site agreement. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, it turns out the chicken company had several reasons that it wanted to do this. It had several people or several entities that it needed to deceive. So first of all, there was a concern with violating the usury laws. That is, the laws that restrict the amount of interest that can be paid. And in order to make sure that they weren't violating the usury laws, the chicken company needed to get an opinion from a lawyer. The lawyer was shown the main agreement, and the lawyer wrote an opinion saying, yes, this is a lease. The lawyer was not shown the side agreement, which is what enabled the lawyer to make the opinion that the lawyer did. So that's deception number one. Deception number two has to do with taxes. The chicken company also wanted to characterize the transaction as a lease rather than a loan because it would wind up paying lower taxes. That is, it could get a full deduction on its lease payments as business expenses rather than having to so-called capitalize these payments and deduct less, that is, interest and some amount for depreciation, which is what would happen if the transaction was really a loan to finance a facility that was, quote, owned by the chicken company. That was deception number two. Deception number three was the chicken company had its own bank, and the bank had agreements with the chicken company, and the agreements had these things called loan covenants. And the loan covenant said things like, you have to maintain a certain asset and liability ratio, which in plain English means you can't have too much debt. And it turns out that if the bank had seen this side agreement, the bank would have gone ballistic because the loan covenants would have been violated because there was too much debt being taken on by chicken company. All right, so there you see at least multiple uses of deception just coming out of one side agreement. But we're not done because the transaction wasn't over yet because Little Chicken Company was bought out by Big Chicken Company, namely Tyson. And Chicken Little, the little company, unlike the cartoon character, does not tell the information to Big Chicken Company, doesn't tell them about the side agreement until after the purchase is completed. But it turned out that Tyson wasn't at least initially injured by this fact, although it could have been. Tyson eventually does find out about the side agreement, but the problem was the builder. Remember the builder? The builder was the person on the other side of the agreement, and the builder got this wonderful idea that it should take out a loan because it needed to invest in some other kind of project of its own design, and decided to use the freezer as the collateral for this loan, because, of course, under the main agreement, the builder owns this freezer facility. Of course, the builder didn't reveal to its own bank that there was this side agreement that negated that proposition, but so be it. So in any case, things go along merrily, except the problem is that the bank that the builder gets this loan from goes under and goes bankrupt, and the builder had not repaid the loan. And Tyson, at that point, wanted to exercise its option, the six-year period being up, at the side agreement price, which was now a very advantageous price because the interest rates had fallen so much that the builder, under the side agreement, would actually owe money to Tyson if Tyson exercised its option. Now, the only problem for Tyson was it couldn't get clear title to this property because the builder had made this loan using the property as collateral. And when the bank went under, the government came in, the government insurer came in, the Office of Thrift Supervision in this particular case, and the government has the benefit of this wonderful rule, which is known as the Dench Doom Doctrine, which is just wonderful to pronounce. I love this. The Dench Doom Doctrine, which basically says that if the government comes in as an insurer and takes over a bank, then any side agreements that are made basically are not enforceable against the government. And so Tyson lost. And the benefits of this deal. So, and actually the real case didn't even involve that. It involved the legal malpractice issue, which I'm not going to get into now. But the basic point is that here you have one little side agreement, or it starts out as one little side agreement, and you have all these different ways that this side agreement and then subsequent side agreements are used to defraud a whole variety of types of people. Okay, so with those examples, let me say a little bit about side agreements and the law. Let me start with a little bit of a discussion about how the law currently thinks about side agreements and what some of the problems might be, and then how the law might think about side agreements and what some changes might some changes that might be desirable in the way the law treats them. Okay, so first, how the law treats side agreements. So there are a variety of ways in which the law interacts or intersects with side agreements. One question, of course, is the question of whether side agreements are enforceable. And this is governed, among other things, by, as I mentioned before, the parole evidence rule of contract law, which makes side agreements unenforceable in a variety of circumstances, but focuses doctrinally mostly on the question of whether or not the main agreement is complete enough, and whether or not the side agreement contradicts the main agreement on the one hand, or might naturally be omitted from the main agreement on the other hand. Now, there are some exceptions to the parole evidence rule that allow certain kinds of evidence of side agreements to be included, such as the fact that in some cases contemporaneous writings are not covered by the parole evidence rule, and so side agreements may come in that way. And more relevant specifically to the kind of signed agreements I'm interested in, there is something known as the sham agreement exception to the parole evidence rule, which basically says that if the party introduces, or the party that wants to prove the side agreement introduces evidence that the real main agreement was intended as a sham, then evidence of the side agreement can come in many cases. Now, why might the parole evidence rule be misguided in dealing with the kind of side agreements I'm talking about? Well, in part because the focus is on the wrong thing. The focus is on the main agreement's completeness, as I said, and things like whether or not evidence of the side agreement is credible, whereas in many of these cases, the evidence of the side agreement is highly credible because it's the real deal. But the problem is it's fraud. And the question is, you know, should the law be sanctioning fraud in that sense? And moreover, courts often, despite the so-called natural omission test, tend to really ignore why the parties might have made the side agreement in the first place, whether for good or bad reasons or otherwise. And most troubling, at least from my perspective, courts almost entirely ignore the effects of enforcement or non-enforcement on third-party interests in these parole evidence cases. So that's the parole evidence rule. But, of course, the parole evidence rule is not the only rule that deals with enforceability. In fact, the parole evidence rule doesn't really enforce anything. It just keeps out some information of proof of side agreements in some cases. But there are other doctrines that might be applicable as well. One, for example, is the idea that contracts that are against public policy are not enforceable on that ground alone. But interestingly, not a lot of law applies this doctrine to side agreements or the kind of fraudulent side agreements I'm interested in. In part because most of the contracts to which the illegality doctrine applies to are illegal on their face. That is, they talk about the what's illegal about the transaction. And the problem with side agreements is you have two agreements that on their face are both perfectly plausible. It's the combination of them that makes the fraud, and that makes apparently some courts uncomfortable with applying the doctrine in that case. I mentioned that, so that's contract law. There are other aspects of law that also deal with enforceability of side agreements. I mentioned the Dench-Doom doctrine already. One of the problems that many commentators and critics of the Dench-Doom doctrine have pointed out is that because it takes this very blanket per se kind of approach to side agreements, it means that there are many situations in which there really isn't any fraud being perpetrated on the government in any meaningful sense, and yet the government gets to take advantage of this doctrine. So that's an alternative way to deal with it, just sort of blanket rules like Dench-Doom. And there are similar rules in another kind of area or group of areas that take a similar kind of approach to side agreements in cases where we might think of them as equal treatment kinds of regimes. That is, situations in which there are a group of people who, for one reason or another, we think ought to be treated the same because they're members of some kind of meaningful group. So to give just a couple of examples, tender offers under the Williams Act, there's a rule that basically, a corporate law rule, that basically says that if you have a tender offer to buy a company, all the shareholders have to get the same deal. And that has come under some degree of criticism because some people think in some categories or in some cases some shareholders are more equal than others. In particular, things people like managers and who might have a desire to have consulting or other kind of agreements with the new company, or sort of the opposite, where they have a covenant not to compete with the new company if they want to go out on their own. And the concern is, and that it seems to be borne out by some cases, that the courts don't allow those kinds of things to be done because of this rule of corporate law. In another somewhat related but legally very distinct area, pension law, ERISA has a similar kind of rule that basically says that every employee benefit plan shall be established and maintained pursuant to a written instrument. Well, it turns out that courts have interpreted this somewhat vague provision to mean that any kind of side agreement or modification of pension plans that's entered into by individual employees with the employer is not enforceable. The rationale being that the idea is to prevent discrimination in favor of some employees compared to others. And there are lots of other examples in the law where you have similar kind of regimes, class actions being another one, where you have courts in some prominent cases, Supreme Court cases like Amchem and Fiber Board, being concerned that not everyone is receiving the same deal, but some people are making essentially side agreements with, let's say, class counsel for better recoveries than other kinds of people and the like. Okay, so this is all having to do with law governing enforceability of the side agreements, but of course that's not the only law that matters to side agreements. There's also the law of fraud. That is, the question here is, when should side agreements be viewed as fraudulent? And of course, I've tried to give some indication of the kinds of side agreements I see as fraudulent, but this is an area of law that is really only developing recently. But there are a couple of cases that talk about at least securities fraud, that if you have side agreements, at least if they're hidden from accountants, that can be evidence of securities fraud, or at least enough to satisfy the heightened pleading standards of securities fraud and the like. But fraud law is also an important aspect. And then there's also, with respect to the secondary parties, the Merrill Lynch in the Barge story and the like, there's also the law of aiding and abetting. And what counts as aiding and abetting, and when people should be viewed as aiders and abettors, whether for purposes of securities laws. And part of the problem here is that there is no aiding and abetting anymore, at least in private security suits, but the SEC can still bring aiding and abetting suits, and aiding and abetting is still a crime. So if the Justice Department or whoever ever wanted to prosecute that, they could do so. But in any case, how aiding and abetting law should develop is another aspect of side agreements that's worth thinking about. So let me say just a little bit about how courts might go about thinking about side agreements, and this is in particular relevant to the fraud question. And what I want to suggest is there are a series of questions that a court might ask in trying to think about whether a side agreement ought to be problematic or not. And one question, of course, is, does the side agreement have any plausible and legitimate purpose that one can identify other than to defraud third parties? And so this is something that actually turns out to be harder to come up with, that is, in terms of a legitimate explanation for them, than it first appears. Although people have tried, courts and commentators and the like have tried to come up with legitimate explanations, but some of them just don't really work that well or not all that convincing. So, for example, some people have tried to argue based on, let's say, the cost of drafting. This is a favorite of economists and the like, that, well, maybe side agreements occur when you have some event that's not likely to happen, or involves an amount of money that's relatively small, or some issue that is a side issue or a contentious issue in negotiations and the like. And that might explain some side agreements. Part of the problem is it doesn't explain a lot of them, at least if the side agreement is itself written, then drafting costs don't do a very good job of explaining why you would have a side agreement. And some terms can be incorporated into main agreement if there's a concern about that you can't identify exactly what it is that you're contracting about. There are terms like reasonable and best efforts and good faith and the like that can be used to deal with those kinds of drafting problems. So drafting costs might explain some side agreements, but not certainly not all, not the ones that I'm interested in, but it might be worth looking at. A second explanation has to do with standardized forms. This is one that the restatement of contracts seems to like. The idea is that if you have standardized forms, that limits the kind of thing that can be put in the standardized form, because standardized forms can't be changed. Well, that's true in some cases, but I've certainly been party to a number of standardized forms, especially for things like wedding bans or house purchases or the like, where there were standardized forms and there were plenty of spaces to add particular concerns or desires and the like to those forms without any need for a side agreement that was separate from the main document. And in fact, it turns out that standardized forms in some cases are actually there for the very purpose of discouraging side agreements. So, for example, a concern that a company might have with the over-enthusiastic or disobedient agent trying to close the deal by offering some kind of special side agreement to these particular customers. So, so the standardized form explanation, again, might be useful in some cases, but has some problems as well. Another more recent explanation of side agreements has to do with the idea that one might want to signal the desire for non-legal enforcement as opposed to legal enforcement, and you use a side agreement to do that. Well, that's okay, but there are problems with that as well. For example, how confident are we, or should we be, that side agreements really do serve as this kind of signal of the desire for non-legal enforcement? And there are certainly some cases where we might be skeptical of this explanation. So, for example, if we think that the parties either can't write down some term in the main agreement, if that's the case, they're prohibited either pragmatically, or they're worried about some kind of legal concern, then why would that signaling the desire for non-legal enforcement work? How do we know that the parties really wouldn't want court enforcement if they could in fact get it? Perhaps in some cases they would. So and in other cases it might be possible for the parties to write into the main agreement that they don't want particular terms to be legally enforced. At least the restatement seems to contemplate that possibility, although we tend not to see it. But in any case, that's one question that one might ask. Another question is, or a second question is, if we decide that there still might be some legitimate reason, or there might be some concern, we might ask: are there third parties who are relying on this main agreement, or on a main agreement, and their interests could be potentially harmed by the side agreement? And this, I think, goes back to some of the cases that we've talked about already, the Tyson's Food Chicken case and the Belgian Software case, which show that there are a lot of potential third parties who could be relying on these main agreements and could be potentially fooled or defrauded by the side agreements, ranging from investors to creditors, to people who purchase contract rights, to people that we now call gatekeepers, the lawyers, accountants, and others. The fact that customers and suppliers, they also may be third parties that could be relying on the main agreement. The government in various guises may be relying on the main agreement. You could have changes in personnel of the companies where the new people coming in are assuming certain things about the contracts that they see and may not know about the side agreement. So there's a whole host of third-party interests that might come up. And there are others that are not present in those cases but might exist in other contexts. Insurers and guarantors might have interests in contracts. There may be partnership kinds of arrangements where the partners are interested in the contracts of other partners and the like. So third-party interests may be very important, but the question is, are they relying in some reasonable sense on this main agreement, and could they be defrauded? If the third party knows about the main agreement, The next question would be, is the side agreement really hidden from the third party? There may be situations in which side agreements are not actually hidden from the third party, in which case the third party isn't really going to be defrauded. So that's another thing that one might look at. Even if the third party is not aware of the side agreement, another question that one might ask is, well, there might be some justifications for secrecy in some cases. That is, there might be legitimate reasons for secrecy in some kinds of transactions, such as there's some intellectual property right that is being protected that the third party doesn't have any right to know about, trade secrets and the like. There may be personal privacy concerns that are at issue. It could very well be that the side agreement is actually combating some other kind of wrongful behavior, such as cheating on a cartel or something along those lines. But one still might want to ask the question, even if there are legitimate secrecy needs or secrecy interests, are secret side agreements always necessary to protect those legitimate secrecy interests? So, for example, one might suggest that sometimes secrecy can be protected by keeping the main agreement secret, not the side agreement. That is, if the third party doesn't have to know about the main agreement, then you don't need a side agreement to keep the secret. Secondly, sometimes the secrecy of the contents of the side agreement may be sufficient without having to keep secret the existence of the side agreement. So, for example, you could have a document that says something like, trade secrets are addressed in a separate confidential document. Or you could have third parties provided a redacted version of the main agreement that takes out the secret information. Or in some cases, you can have a contract that deals with confidential matter but doesn't need to describe the nature of the confidential information itself. So you could have an employee-employer contract that says something like, employee will not reveal any trade secrets, without defining what exactly those trade secrets are. So the basic point here is that the fact that, or notice of existence of side agreements to the third party may in some cases be sufficient to protect the third party's interests. And then finally, the last question one might think about is, are both parties to the side agreement equally culpable? What one might call the reluctant side dealer problem. And the idea here is to go back to my differentiation between primary parties like Enron and secondary parties like Merrill Lynch. One might ask the question, why do the secondary parties go along with the side agreements, and should they be viewed in any way as less culpable? So there are several reasons why the secondary parties might go along, one of which is that the secondary party may get better terms in the side agreement in exchange for acquiescing in the secrecy, right? And so this might explain in part the Tyson chicken case, why the secondary parties might have gone along with the side agreement there. And I'm reminded of the old Woody Allen joke from Annie Hall that many of you might know, where someone goes into a psychiatrist's office and says, "Doc, my brother is crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "Well, why don't you turn him in?" And the guy says, "Well, I would, but I need the eggs." So it could be that in many of these cases, the secondary party needs the eggs, and they go along with the side agreement for that reason. Or you could have a situation like the Enron barge situation, where the secondary party may get better terms outside the agreement, that is, future dealings and the like, and they're going along to preserve the possibility for future dealings. Or, like in the Belgian software example, you can have a secondary party that is, to some extent, controlled by the primary party. It turns out in the Belgian software case, many of the customers were actually sort of shell companies that were controlled by the software company, and that's why they bought even pretended to buy some of those things. But in any case, you can have that kind of control as well. This also happened with Enron with its control of its special purpose entities and the like. So that's another question one might ask. So what can the law do then about side agreements? And what I want to suggest very quickly in the last couple of minutes here is just a couple of ways that the law might actually deal with the side agreements and then close with some broader implications. So, in terms of the rights of contracting parties against each other, what might the law do? That is, the enforcement of the side agreement question. Well, the easy way to sort of state my thesis about this, is that if the side agreement is part of the fraudulent, some kind of fraudulent transaction, then what contract and other kind of regulatory law should aim to do is three things. One, try to deter the fraudulent side agreement, or future side agreements. Two, try to facilitate the protection of third-party interests, such as recovery for fraud. And then three, try to punish the primary party more than the secondary party, if to the extent feasible, if it turns out that we really think the primary party is more culpable. All right, so how does this actually work, then, in the question of enforcement? So one might think of three possible options the law has in terms of enforcement. In terms of the side agreement, and the main agreement, the law can do one of three things. One is enforce neither, one is enforce the main agreement, and one, of course, is to enforce the side agreement. And each position has something that might be said to it for it and some problems with it as well. So enforcing neither agreement is the route that the law almost never seems to take, perhaps surprisingly, the pox on both your houses approach, even though in some cases one might think this makes some degree of sense, especially if you have a deal that wouldn't have been made at all but for the fraud, and so therefore, in economist terms, is not joint welfare maximizing, and even where one could say the whole transaction, as a result, is illegal and should therefore be viewed as unenforceable. There are a couple of problems with this in terms of some of the goals that I was mentioning before. One is the problem of fraud revelation, and that is that if neither the primary nor the secondary party can recover against the other, then neither one is going to have an incentive to bring out the fraud, and so the fraud might not be revealed when it otherwise could be. So if there are situations where we want fraud revelation to come from one of the parties, then we might not want to have this rule that you don't enforce either agreement. Similarly, this might not be the best way to protect third-party interests. Third parties might actually be better off with either enforcement or no enforcement. Enforcement of the main agreement or enforcement of the side agreement for similar kinds of concerns. So the second possibility is, well, why not enforce the main agreement? And one way to do this is through a strict application of the parole evidence rule, that is, to keep evidence of the side agreements out. The argument for doing this is that in some cases, this actually may help third parties. Why? Because in some cases, it might actually eliminate the losses that third parties would otherwise suffer. So to give just a quick example of this, suppose you have a state statute that requires that a certain amount of money had to be raised for building a bridge, money that the state thought was necessary to make the bridge safe. And there was a contract between the town and the potential builders of the bridge that said that X amount of dollars, the amount that was required, was actually raised. But there was a side agreement that says that the money didn't have to be paid. And the court allowed the town to actually enforce the main agreement using the parole evidence rule and rejecting the so-called sham exception because that protected the government's interest in having the safe bridge being built. So that's an example of where enforcing the main agreement might actually be a good thing. The problem with this solution is that sometimes in situations where the secondary party, like the Merrill Lynch in the barge example, prefers the side agreement, then the secondary party, if the main agreement is enforced, is going to bear the full risk of the fraud, even if the primary party was the main wrongdoer. And we might say, well, too bad on the secondary party. They deserve what they got for participating in the side agreement. But we might not want to punish the secondary party to that degree. So you might say, okay, well then we should enforce the side agreement, and that's a third possibility, right? That sometimes it might make sense to actually enforce the side agreement. Now the question is, how would that impact third parties? Well, in some cases, it actually might help, or we might. We might make it help the third parties. So one way in which the side agreement could be enforced and third parties could be helped is a court might say, yes, we'll enforce the fraudulent side agreement, but the IRS has to be informed that it has been defrauded. So we'll condition this on, you know, sending a nice little note to the IRS that this transaction really is a loan rather than what you characterize it to be, and allow the IRS to recover against you. So we might try to have rules that say something like that. In the equal treatment kinds of cases, we might have a rule that says that maybe if someone makes a side agreement for a better deal, just like if you have gum in line, you have to give it to everyone, you have to give the better deal to everyone. And that might be an alternative solution. Again, it's not one that the courts seem to have favored, but it's one that could be adopted. So those are all possibilities dealing with enforcement or non-enforcement of either the main or the side agreement. One could also have other kinds of solutions that are based on the idea of notice. Notice to the third parties, which in many cases solves the problem of fraud. So, for example, in class actions, there's a state law rule, the class action rule for Minnesota, which basically requires the disclosure of any kind of agreement that is made in connection with a class action settlement. Or, as I said, you could have, in a case like the Tyson case, you could have this required notice, maybe after the fact, to the IRS or some other relevant government agency so that they can pursue the legitimate claims. Okay, so that's the law on side agreements. So I'm going to finish up with just a couple of observations about side agreements and what they have to say about our theories about contract and contract law. So as I said, many of the theories of contract that have been developed are based on what I referred to earlier as the complete contract paradigm, which basically posits that there shouldn't be any side agreements, that everything should just be put in the contract. And the puzzle that needs to be explained is the fact that some contracts aren't as complete as we might like them to be, and the answer to the puzzle is based on some version of the fact that there are transaction costs between the contracting parties. But side agreements kind of upend this this idea because they basically render contracts that would otherwise be complete incomplete deliberately. They are agreements that are deliberately made as a vehicle of deception, not a consequence of transaction costs. And this idea, I think, carries over to lots of other areas that have been of interest to contract theorists in recent times. So another example would be the problem of objective versus subjective objectivism versus subjectivism. So the objective idea, the objective theory of contract and the like, says we ought to favor written over oral terms and the like because the written terms better evidence the real intentions of the parties. Well, side agreements, again, upend this basic idea, the basic idea that the objective approach really represents the real intention of the parties. In fact, it's the side agreement, which is often oral, that represents the real intention of the parties. It just happens to be that it's a fraudulent intention of the parties. And so so on down the line. The same thing could be said of things like non-legal versus legal enforcement. Sometimes side agreements can show that non-legal enforcement is not a problem, as theorists like to put it, of court incompetence in figuring out what the agreement is. The problem is, the reason why parties want non-legal enforcement in this example is they're trying to evade court protection of third parties that would otherwise exist. And to take another popular theory from recent times, the so-called crowding out theory, that sometimes legal enforcement might actually discourage the development of non-legal norms and the like. Well, side agreements also call that into question, at least in these contexts, because legal and non-legal enforcement coexist simultaneously, perfectly fine, with lots of money at stake, and the non-legal enforcement doesn't seem to be discouraged at all. That is, people seem to be doing these deals. So there are lots of ways in which contract theory can, I think, benefit from thinking about side agreements and the contract as property idea. Similarly, contract doctrine might benefit from thinking more about third-party rights in a lot of areas. And if you think about a lot of the cases that we actually talk about in contract law, many of them involve third-party interests, but the third-party interests are never talked about in the cases. So everything from consideration, where you have, in the famous Hamer versus Sidway case, contracts being assigned and people dying and executors present, that is irrelevant to the analysis of the doctrine. You have cases involving involving subcontractor bids, where the only focus is on one aspect of the deal, the subcontractor-general contractor relationship. The other contract between the general contractor and the owner of the deal is not talked about at all and is not thought about at all in the cases, and on and on. So, in conclusion, the overall lesson that I think we can take from side agreements and the problems that I've been talking about is that sometimes we need to look to the side to see what's right in front of us. Thank you.